food trends have been led us about by the nose for a long, long time, probably as long as we can possibly remember. And one of the ways we can possibly remember things is through the pages of very, very old books. And who better to tell us where those food trends have taken us way back in the past than an antiquarian book collector and seller? And so let's ask him, what can food trends of the past tell us about food trends in the future?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, thank you, Will Strickland, and hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,100th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Forest who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Jason, I have a question for you.
Fire away.
Do you think food trends of 600, 700, 800 years ago can point to food trends in 600, 700, 800 years into the future?
You know, I think that we live in this world, things tend to go in cycles. So I imagine that we can learn a lot from our past.
That's what we're going to do today. We're going to look way back in the past. You know, folks, as a teenage herbicide growing up in the bean fields of Montana, I resolved to get as far away from the business of hoeing weeds as possible, and so studied English and Chinese literature at the University of California, thinking that's about as far away as I could get. What I enjoyed most while looking into the classic works of these two cultures was finding conditions that were shared by both. As the cultures evolved apart from each other, I considered the conditions they shared to be kind of like universals. Here's an example of one of those universals by Tang Dynasty poet Li Shen. It's called Toiling Farmers. Farmers weeding at noon, sweat down the field soon. Who knows food on a tray, thanks to their toiling day? One universal shared by all is a dominant relationship of food to culture. Food trends have led cultures throughout history, and one place to see that leading about in action is in Food Fights and Culture Wars by antiquarian cookbook collector and seller Tom Nealon. So let's ask Tom today, what can food trends of the past tell us about food trends of the future? Tom, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Program.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Pleasure to have you aboard. So, first of all, you worked in restaurants for a long time, right?
When I was younger, but mostly doing, you know, line cooking and dishwashing and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that was always my favorite job, is dishwashing in restaurants.
Yeah, those are the best.
Hot and sticky and dirty and, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, so, in Texas, too, so the hot was hot.
Yeah, sure was, because that's where you got them clean. So you went from working in restaurants and working in the food industry to actually being a bookseller, right?
Yeah, I opened a bookshop here in Boston with my brother in 2003.
Mm-hmm. Selling paperback books and used books of all kinds?
Yeah, it started out just general used stuff, and then over the years it slowly turned into more rare and valuable books. But
what constitutes a rare book? I mean, in the open marketplace, I suppose the rarer they are, the more valuable they are.
Sometimes, I mean, there's a lot of books that are rare and still not worth anything because, you know, there might be three copies, but nobody wants one of them. So they're not very valuable. And then there's books where there's hundreds or even thousands of copies, but they're worth a lot. You know, I think Hemingway or that sort of thing, where he was popular even back then, so there's thousands of copies of first editions of Hemingway. Mm-hmm. So those are valuable, but not really rare. But usually we sort of muddle them together in the vernacular. So it's books that you don't see very often, maybe once a year, every couple of years.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of gravitated toward medieval material, correct?
Yeah, that's what I'd studied in school. I'd sort of had a thing for Chaucer and had studied some...
Were you an English lit major?
That was an English lit major. Yeah.
Okay, me too. So that's what you get. You get Chaucer. Why did they teach? Why did they teach Chaucer? What is the significance of him?
Well, I think you know there's lots of old poetry and that you read and you can't really figure out why it's stuck around so long. But Chaucer is so full of funny stories and dirty jokes and you know. But it's you know, the English version of Boccaccio, so there's lots of ribald stuff and, you know, people doing terrible things to each other. And it's very modern in that way.
And, you know, he's kind of one of those people who really were responsible for bringing the English language to the fore, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, that's the version of English that stuck, partially because Chaucer wrote in it. Because there were a bunch of different Englishes in different parts of England at the time. Because the Normans had come over and they'd sort of muddled the whole thing with all the French. And he writing in that Kentish turned into what we now know of as English, and the other one sort of died out. It's a big deal that he sort of gave birth to what we speak now.
Mm-hmm. And thus, you know, ensured his place in literary history. I remember one of my Chaucer professors was so obsessed with his PhD on Chaucer that I thought he was going to pull his hair out. And thinking about that, you know, there have been so many doctoral theses written on Chaucer and Shakespeare and whatnot, and yet they keep finding new stuff to write about.
Yeah, it is sort of remarkable that they're that deep. And it helped, and it, like I said, it helps that they're written in something that you can still read Chaucer. It's difficult, but it's not like reading Gawain and the Green Knight, which is a great poem, but is much harder to read because that's that English that didn't turn into what we speak.
Mm-hmm. Did you study Chaucer in the Middle English?
I did, yeah.
No, I did too, but I certainly forgot most of it by now. So one of the things in looking back into the pages of old books, I have to ask on behalf of half this town and California, did you find any evidence of vegetarianism back in the Middle Ages?
Obviously in the Middle Ages, most regular folk had what was essentially forced vegetarianism on them. You know, they were mostly living on beer and bread.
Beer and bread. It's essentially the same thing, right?
Yeah. Liquid yeah. Bread and bread, and maybe a few vegetables. And so they were eating almost no meat. But as a theory, it goes back to there's, you know, Romans talked about vegetarianism. There's maybe less in the Middle Ages. Then you had it come back in the Enlightenment because Rousseau and Voltaire were really into vegetarianism. And in the 17th century, there was Thomas Tryon and I think Porphyry during the Roman Empire wrote about vegetarianism. So it sort of flowed in and out of favor. Rich people never were vegetarians, essentially.
Even the famous philosophers, Rousseau and so on.
Oh, no, I mean, obviously there were people who were doing it as to make a point, but I don't think it ever caught on amongst the moneyed classes very much, other than in, you know, Thomas Tryon did write in the 17th century, and then Benjamin Franklin read that and tried it out and sort of famously. So it did, but I don't know if it ever really stuck in the West that I can think of.
Now, as you go back in time and are picking up these very old books and manuscripts and whatnot, and you know, you come up with some pretty interesting theories in your book, Food Fights and Culture Wars. How closely are the two related, the facts and the fictions, and the facts and the thesis, I should say?
Well, you know, I think like in life, I try to wind them together enough that you can't really tell them apart. All of the ideas are
like all good literary people, right?
Exactly.
That's what we do.
Yeah. But I mean, they're all meant to be thoughtful. You know, whether they're true or not, I don't know. But they're supposed to resonate and make you think about the place of food in the world. And some of them are, you know, some of them I'm serious. And I mean, I'm serious about all of them. Whether I'm serious enough to call them truthful and correct. But, you know, I don't like certainty, so...
There you go. Well, and who does when it gets right down to it? Because once things are certain, that's it.
There's nothing to talk about. There's nothing to discuss.
And we have so much to talk about today, and I'm looking so forward to it, from Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales all the way through the great medieval things that you have picked up. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're looking back in time at the food trends that of the Middle Ages, the medieval periods. We're talking, when are we talking? What times are we talking, Tom?
The areas that I cover the most are the ones where there's the most cookbooks. So there's ancient Rome. There's a good cookbook that you can learn a lot from. And then again, in the Middle Ages, there starts to be manuscripts. And then a lot from the Renaissance through the Enlightenment.
Okay. And what did those trends consist of? Where did they take us way back then? Think about it. I wonder if those trends way back then can point us to what will happen way deep in the future. So this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson and Tom Nealon, the author of Food Fights and Culture Wars. And you, join us today or at 831-479-1080. Right back.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it. Metro farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it. Metro farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, it's back to, way back to, hundreds of years ago, to the Canterbury Tales, that wonderful stories of those pilgrims on the way to Canterbury sat down and told each other, as related by Geoffrey Chaucer himself, and Tom Nealon, who has picked up the Canterbury Tales and looked into what they were cooking up for us. What were they cooking up back in those days in the Canterbury Tales, Thomas?
The thing that I became most sort of obsessed with, I decided I was going to cook a lot of the things mentioned in the Canterbury Tales. And the story that I think most caught my eye early on was these pies that this, the cook, who's this scurrilous cook, he's a cheat, and he would make the pies and then drain the blood out of the bottom of the pies and then cork them back up, reheat them, and sell them to people, these lousy, reheated, dry pies. I just thought it was such a funny idea that these people were stealing gravy. And in a reselling it on the secondary gravy market back then.
Secondary gravy market?
Yeah, they drain all the stuff out and then sell it to people for, you know, the blood, they'd called it, out of the bottom of these meat pies, and then sell it to somebody else.
So essentially it must have been the fats, right?
Yeah, the fat and the juices that...
And then, so you started cooking some of the things that you found in there. Talk about the chicken of the day the chicken that you cooked, so that was fried to look like a chicken.
Oh, that's from a little earlier, but the same sort of period. It's from a cookbook, a manuscript cookbook that survived, and that's one of these my favorite ones, where you would take the chicken legs and the thighs, and boil the meat, take the meat off, boil the bones until they were perfectly nice and white, and then take the meat, stick it back on the bone, and fry it back on there with some, you know, breadcrumbs, so that it looked more or less like it looked in the first place before you started, you know, this fake chicken that was actually real.
And you started cooking some of these things then as a way of really looking back into the past, right?
Yeah, it was sort of a way of participating and trying to get a feel for, even if you can't do it exactly like, but sort of get a feel for some of the weird spices and the flavors.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seemed to be that from the very get-go, where was the very get-go? Where was the first cookbooks? Where did they come from?
The first, there's actually there's fragments of Babylonian tablets that have recipes on it, but so they were making cookbooks even back then, but most of them haven't survived. The first real full one is Apicius, which was written in the 4th or 5th century, documenting before the fall of the Roman Empire what they were eating towards the peak or the of the empire.
What was it they were eating?
They were eating, there was a lot, you know, there was a lot of trade through that region, so there was a pretty big variety, but the thing that's most striking when you go through the cookbook is how they were putting this fermented fish sauce on everything.
Really?
Yeah, it's made with, the good stuff is made with mackerel guts that were, like, salted and sort of left out to ferment, usually in the sun. And then they started making it out of, as they didn't have enough mackerel to make the good stuff, they would make it out of almost any sea creature, cockles and...
Uh-huh. So and people still do that today, of course.
There's a lot of Asian fish sauces that it would be similar to that, and obviously the English were crazy about things made with anchovies that wouldn't have been too much different.
Mm-hmm.
Worcestershire sauce is sort of a fancied up version of that.
So in that time, trade played a significant role in food already.
Well, it was huge, but the Roman Empire had put so much stuff together that all those trade routes going through, so they were able to, you know, do things like move the wheat to Egypt so that they could grow other stuff in Italy. And they even started to move the fish factories because Roman citizens complained and had enough power to move these fish sauce factories that smelled so bad to places like Spain so that they wouldn't be bothered. And then they would import the fish sauce back to...
It's interesting because that's exactly what we're doing today. We take the factories that are dirty and move them to China.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was Spain. Spain was their China.
Of the time.
Huh? Yeah.
Then I was just thinking about the notion of gravy, going back to gravy in the Canterbury Tales, because that really points to the hunger for fats, does it not?
Yeah, I mean, now we try to avoid fats, but back then, the fat and protein were the hardest things to get, for sure. Those are the things that you would die without.
So, and that's the thing, that's why there was a secondary market in gravy.
Sure, yeah, yeah. The poor people were, you know, they were just scraping by, and they were trying to save some money and buy slightly cheaper pies from this guy, and, you know, probably being pushed that much closer to starvation as a result.
Mm-hmm.
So and then, it's a funny story, but it points to something, yeah, very serious.
Yeah, exactly. And the notion of today we're avoiding fats, and then we're scratching our heads going, well, should we be avoiding fats, or should we be avoiding some fats and not other fats? And we're scratching our noggins and not really sure what to do. But back in those days, there was such a hunger for it that they knew what to do. And
you needed those fats. Yeah. There was no wringing your hands about which yeah. sort of fats you were going to eat. Or, yeah.
Well, and then in the 16th century, the Nostradamus, and you start talking about, you know, the secrets and the Book of Secrets and how, the various means of ways of doing things were secret.
Yeah, that was very popular in the Renaissance, and Nostradamus wrote one of the earlier ones. Detailing, there's sort of like a lot of it was be similar to what you get in like these do-it-yourself books, or you know, like 500 easy ways to you know,
cooking for idiots.
Yeah, yeah. So you had, but some of them were secrets. So it was sort of a weird mixture of some cookery and some, you know, how to make like paints and varnish and how to get, you know, dirt out of things, and then also some alchemy, you know, some weird stuff and how to, you know, I think there's a love jam that Nostradamus made where it was supposed to make it was so perfect and that it would make a woman fall in love if she ate this jam.
Mm-hmm. And think of what you could sell that for today.
I know, right?
From Nostradamus' very own secret recipe.
Nostradamus' secret jam. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Well, and then there was the notion of food or medicine in the early cookbooks.
Yeah, no, it was a lot of certain ingredients would be muddled for centuries. Chocolate was sort of both. You know, it was a food, and you'd go to these pretty early on in the middle of the 17th century. They had chocolate houses that popped up in England, but at the same time, it was viewed as, you know, the cure for all these different things.
And advertised as such, of course.
Sure, yeah, so you could sell it like that. They famously, it was sold to rich guys to give to their mistresses to prevent venereal diseases.
Huh. And also, you talk about how the early Catholics were using it to hide poison, hide the taste of poison.
Yeah, because you put that in the bitterness, hit, you know, because so many poisons were bitter, that you know, a lot of people were killed by, the, I think, the Medicis and the various people using, the Jesuits were famous for their chocolate, poisoned chocolate confections.
Would he, really?
Yeah.
And what was, how was that? What would they use, what would the Jesuits be using poisoned chocolate for?
Oh, just to get rid of political rivals. You know, just what you did back in the 17th century.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you would think the Catholic order of the Jesuits would not be that way, but I guess they're just like all the rest of us human beings, right?
Yeah, they had, you know, the Jesuits did have a funny history where, you know, early on they were interested in culture and all that, but, you know, they got so powerful that trying to hold on to it, did a lot of that in the 17th and 18th century, and then eventually got excommunicated and then brought back, and yeah, they were all over the place, those Jesuits.
So power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts,
yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly. And yeah, I mean, obviously they run all these great universities now, and we think of them as the most thoughtful of the Catholics, but they have a sordid history.
They have that history like everybody else. When they get back from this coming break, I'd like to talk about the foods that were popular that we ate way back then. What did we eat? There were different kinds of foods for different kinds of classes. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson today with Tom Nealon, the author of Food Fights and Culture Wars. It was food that led us about for so long and will probably be leading us out about in the future. So where did it take us? Where will it take us? 831-547-1980 is the phone number. Join us if you wish.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, let's go back, way, way back to the 1500s and see what we were eating way back then. Seems like Tom Nealon, the author of Food Fights and Culture Wars, had two different kinds of foods, one for the rich folk and one for all the rest of us. Well, all the rest of us pretty much ate bread and drank beer, which is essentially the same thing, could catch whatever else we could. But the rich folk, they got some stuff to eat, and it sounded like pretty exotic stuff. What were they eating way back then, Tom?
It was the beginning of when the spice trade really started to show up in Western Europe. So they were, and it continued obviously as the Dutch East India and British East India Company went over to and brought even more stuff over from the, you know, 14th to the 16th century, and then some of the stuff that had come over during the Crusades. So they were eating a wide variety of stuff. Sugar and almonds had just gotten incredibly popular. So you see those. So those are almost like the fish sauce of 14th century England, where they just started putting almonds and sugar and everything.
Do you ever run across accounts of when sugar was introduced, what the reaction was? I imagine it must have been something.
Oh, yeah. It was. I mean, they thought it was, it showed up in those medical books, too, where they were like, maybe it's medicine. It's so good, you know, so they would just, yeah, they were crazy about it, because it was this new thing, getting it from the
new taste, and here it is. And I suspect it was probably pretty expensive because you had to get it from far away in the tropics.
Yeah, it all came from the Middle East then, so you had to bring it in sacks, and obviously refining techniques weren't what they were now, so it was very expensive. So were almonds. Almonds until they started being grown in Spain and in big enough numbers that they weren't quite as expensive, but mm-hmm. almonds were very expensive back then, too.
So how would they combine sugar and almonds then?
They would just put them both in. Almonds were very frequently used to make almond milk, where you crush them up and then simmer them with the milk and with the water, mm-hmm. and it turns into this milky substance that's not unlike almond milk now. Get commercial almond milk. And then they would put that in all these dishes.
Mm-hmm.
Blancmange was made with almond milk, and it was just a very popular flavor, these almonds that were showing up.
And still is.
It's still crazy popular. That's right.
You talk about different kinds of meat they were eating then.
Yeah, there were still some
like things. Turtle doves, for example.
Turtle doves were very, very popular. I mean, they're not too dissimilar from quail, but there's a much wider variation because there wasn't all this commercial farming of these birds. So they would whatever you had around is what you would eat, and a lot of them were. So the recipes eventually pinned down to what were being raised domestically, right. But they were eating everything in the sky. They would eat, you know, like the blackbirds and the pie, and that was all things that were very commonly eaten.
Anything they could catch, they put in the pie.
Sure, yeah.
What exactly was the pie? Just a regular pastry with whatever you could find inside?
More frequently, because cooking techniques were so limited back then, more frequently you'd have a pie that was really just built to be a pot. So it would have really thick sides, and mostly the crust would be mostly inedible. And it was mostly just there to keep all the juices inside. Make sure that it cooked properly. So usually you often wouldn't eat the pie, especially in the Middle Ages.
Huh. So the green part of it would be tossed aside then.
Yeah, I mean, because it would almost be like mortar at that point. Yeah. It was so thick and so well cooked.
You talk a lot about mutton. Eating a lot of mutton, and also pork and pork fat.
Pork fat was huge because pigs is one of the few things that, you know, only really poor people wouldn't be able to have, like, a pig. And you can do a lot with a pig. You can save, you know, you can save the fat and hang it up and eat just about the whole thing. And pigs more or less eat what people do, so you can just throw them whatever scraps. Right. Pigs is just about the easiest thing for...
They're like chickens, right? When it comes to grazing, and you could feed chickens just about anything, and pigs as well.
Yeah, so that was about what regular folk, that was the meat that they would have, was the occasional bits of pork, and then the pork fat, which they would put to flavor all sorts of dishes that would otherwise be vegetarian.
Ah, okay. So the fat carries the flavors, and that way you can have taste in things that otherwise would not have taste.
Exactly, yeah. So pork fat was a huge ingredient.
And then, you know, the spice trade is of interest, of course, because that really sent people throughout the world looking for new tastes.
Yeah, and then you get it, so they sort of wag the dog, too. So, you know, the tail starts wagging the dog where they find these new products and then try to drum up demand for it back home so that they continue to do it. So it all gets very muddled as, like, global capitalism starts getting involved.
Was saffron a good case in point?
Saffron, yeah, because it was so expensive, so there was so much money to be made. I mean, like now, anything, the more expensive something is, the more likely it is to get muddled and corrupt. So I'm sure if you looked at the saffron trade, it was a complete mess.
And saffron, of course, is that yellow material, right, from a flower.
Yeah, the pestle, yeah.
And very, very hard to cultivate.
It's really expensive because there's no good way to do it. In a mass sort of way.
And so saffron's still very expensive.
Still expensive, yeah.
Yeah. Now, do we use it in anything today, saffron?
We still use it in, you know, yellow rices, and it's got that great aroma. So it's still used in a fair number of Middle Eastern and Eastern dishes. I know it's big in, they're trying to get, there's this great company actually trying to get people to grow saffron in Afghanistan instead of poppies.
Well, good luck on that.
One of the few cash crops.
Yeah. What about the artifice in the foods of those times? You talk about one, you talk about peacock on a dish, and I go through, whoa. Artifice was a big part of the presentation of food, was it not?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's where all those ideas of entremets, which were sometimes food and sometimes actual theatrical productions involving food in between meals. It was a huge thing, especially for royalty. And they would do the peacock. They'd carefully skin the whole thing and then cook the bird and then put the skin back on and hope people didn't die of, you know, whatever.
Whatever, yeah.
Diseases peacocks are carrying around.
So what was the word, entremets?
Entremets, yeah, which are now sort of like little things in between courses, but back then could be elaborate theatrical productions in between courses. I think in Hamlet, that play that they put on is an entremet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gotcha. Okay, right. Yeah. Right, right. So an entertainment between courses, because, of course, eating was the... Yeah, that's what you did. That was the big entertainment then. That's how.
Oh, yeah, and if you were a lord, you were probably having a big number of people over. That was the day's activity.
Mm-hmm. So getting together for dinner was the big deal. Well, and that's where we're at today. Is the big deal of our food and the relationship of culture to food, and how that food trends throughout the years have kind of led us around. As it were, and we chase them, and we're still chasing them today. Today's one of the hot trends, of course, is superfoods. And I'll bet they had superfoods back then. So that's what we'll ask Tom Nealon when we get back from this break. He is the author of Food Trends and Culture Wars and the relationship of both. This is The Food Chain. You are invited to participate if you wish. Questions about medieval foods, let us know. 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080, right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, today we chase superfoods about, like kale. Oh, my goodness, think of the things that kale can do for you. How about beets? Oh, yeah, they'll take it to you. Back then must have been superfoods. I think probably start with chocolate. They must have really thought a lot of that, especially when you put sugar in it, right, Tom Nealon?
Yeah, chocolate was definitely a mania when they brought it from Mexico to Europe. And even in Mexico it was, the Mayans used it as money, the beans. So they thought very highly of it as well.
And probably for good reason. Enough to start a war, right, between England and Spain?
Yeah, England wanted those the plantations to grow cacao in the Caribbean. So, yeah, they had a little miniature war over land to grow chocolate on.
And people, I guess, really, when it gets right down to it, if you're going to fight over something, probably food, good thing to fight over, because it's the one thing we really do need, that and water.
Certainly, it's at least more honest than some of the other reasons.
Yeah. See, if you're going to conjure up an excuse to go to war, food is a good one.
We're out of food.
Yeah. Works better than almost anything else. Well, and with respect to that, they've been fighting over food for quite a while. You talk a little bit about the Crusades and how you think that it might have been possible that the Crusades were actually a consequence of bad grain. Want to tell that story?
Sure, yeah. The ergot was infecting all of the grain in Western Europe. And as
ergot is like a mold?
Yeah, it's a fungus. It's fungus? A sort of a reddish fungus, and it cuts down on yields, but it can also... it's similar to LSD, but more deadly ultimately, where it creates manias and you'd have hallucinations and all these other things. And everyone, in addition, was already on the verge of starvation, so much of the peasantry in Europe, and cutting down these yields, and then you add to it all of these symptoms.
Literally, the population was starving and going crazy at the same time.
Which made it really easy for this guy, Peter the Hermit, and the Pope to sort of get all of these people enraged about the Muslims and march the People's Crusade, which was one of the largest number-wise parts of the Crusade, like 100,000 starving, hallucinating European peasants marching to the Middle East.
But may as well get out of town one way or another, right?
So right, yeah.
There
and
it is.
They just ravaged everything sort of thoughtlessly the whole way, as you might expect.
And, of course, ergot is something we look for today as well. I mean, it hasn't gone away. It's still there, so we have to really guard against it, correct?
Yeah, they just didn't know at all what it was. So, it'll cut down on the harvest, and you'll notice maybe you throw some out, but it usually doesn't year to year get worse because you're paying attention to it. But back then, every year, you would have been cutting down more of the harvest, and there'd be more ergot that they were eating in the grain.
And getting crazier and crazier and crazier.
Crazier and crazier, yeah.
And that would, of course, affect everybody because everybody ate grain.
Yep, yeah. That
rich was and poor alike.
The staple of just about one of the only things everybody had in common.
And, of course, another big scourge of the time was the Black Plague. And you came up with a real interesting theory about the relationship of lemons and the plague.
Yeah, so this was in the middle of the 17th century, which was the last time the bubonic plague swept through Europe, and it had hit city after city. It famously hit London a bit before this, and then led to the fire.
It kind of went through in waves, didn't it, the plague?
Yeah, because, you know, it's so virulent, but so deadly that it burns itself out. You know, everybody dies, and then it can't continue to replicate itself.
Right. And you postulate that Paris was able to escape the plague on the last big wave because people were drinking a lot of lemonade.
That's right. So Paris, which you would have thought would have been one of the cities to be worst hit with the big population and all the people moving through, didn't get hit at all in the 1660s. And my notion is that they'd just at that time picked up drinking lemonade from the Italians. Lemonade had always been sort of popular, but all of a sudden there were more varieties and they were closer by because of commerce, and you could actually get lemons in bulk for semi-reasonable prices, and sugar as well. So everybody in Paris was starting to drink lemonades, and lemon, the peels, have limonene in it, which is an insecticide. It breaks down the exoskeleton of the fleas and kills them. So the idea is they're on all these rats, and the rats are going through the garbage, as rats do, and they need to be passing the fleas on to the people, and then the people die and pass it back to the rats, and then the rats die, pass it back to the people. But the rats are running through the garbage and running up against all these lemon rinds and whatnot, and it kills the fleas and breaks down the whole process.
And thus, Paris was able to escape. Did people kind of wonder why we're getting away with not dying?
They did what they did, although, as you might expect, you know, the bureaucrats and whatnot were quick to take.
Yeah, we did this, right?
Exactly. So that's what happened. You know, the cardinals and bureaucrats said, oh, it's because we aired out these goods. You know, they'd quarantine the goods. But, of course, you can't quarantine the rats, which is where the fleas are. So you quarantine the goods because they thought it was, miasma, noxious fumes that were causing it.
And there it is. And do we still think of noxious miasma? Does that still come into play? Do we still think of that? Noxious fumes?
Some, but I think we, you know, because we've learned the...
Just on long flights on airliners, right?
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, all right, folks.
We've gotten away from that idea.
Folks, this is Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host today, Tom Nealon. We're looking way back in history at the way we used to be and the things we used to eat. And so when we come back, we'll have a few minutes, and I'd like to ask Tom, you know, if there are things we can learn from what we ate way back then about what we'll eat in the future. This is the Food Chain. Right back. Do stay tuned.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And we do have a few minutes left with Tom Nealon, the author of Food Fights and Culture Wars, and a proprietor of Pazzo Books, P-A-Z-Z-O, Books. If you're out looking for some rare and exotic things, to books to invest your money in, you'll find some very interesting ones at Pazzo Books. And we thank Tom for joining us today. So you've been looking at these things for quite a while. You're looking at back in history and you're seeing these interesting trends. You know, when you look at them, do you think people change all that much over the course of time?
I don't really. I think the forces that operate on people shift around that maybe make it appear that people are changing more than they are, but I don't think people have fundamentally changed very much.
We still eat food, right?
Yeah, I think we're still driven, by the same sort of basic motivations most of the time.
Now, if you look at the way we flit about with respect to our food trends, you know, for two decades, food or fat is bad. And now we're looking at people who are saying, well, wait a minute, fat isn't bad. You need fat. Do you ever wonder why we haven't figured it out?
I mean, it's really been thousands of years of that, with new ideas. You know, there was water cures and there were, you know, eat chocolate and cure your ills, or eat sugar or don't eat sugar. You would think that after all of these people telling us what to do had been wrong over and over and over and over again, that we might learn something from it, but we don't seem to, do we?
Well, do you think we will in the future?
I mean, I think it's probably, you know, 4 steps forward, 3 steps back. I think we're making progress, you know, understanding vitamins and what our bodies need. I think we're just not doing it as quickly as we could. So I think we're making progress. It just could be obscured by how dumb we are sometimes.
What do you think about the nature of our ability to produce food now? I mean, I think about the diet of those poor people in the Middle Ages, which has consisted primarily of beer and bread and whatever they could scrounge. We're still doing that pretty much with most of our food is carbohydrate based.
Yeah, same thing with you know, the Aztec Empire, which is one of the biggest empires in the world. They're mostly just eating corn. Yeah, there's that story over and over again where there's one basic grain that everybody's getting all their protein from.
And as a consequence, you know, that we, I think of the plagues that we suffered in the past, and now the plague seems to be diabetes. Do you ever run across diabetes in medieval literature?
You know, people, the lifespans were short enough back then, and the medicine was bad enough that some of those diseases, you know, they'd get bunched in with other bunches of symptoms that people might have. But I don't know that much about it, but I can't think of anything that would have been somebody figuring that out. You know, the lifespans were short enough that some of those diseases that largely affect people later in life.
What was the lifespan back then?
I think the average lifespan, including, you know, the peasantry, was still in the 30s.
In the 30s?
In the 30s for most of the Middle Ages. Now, there were plenty of people, you know, wealthier people living into their 80s, but the average lifespan, there were so many people dying young.
Well, maybe that's what we can look forward to 700 years from now, is the fact that we'll live 700 years. Tom Nealon, thank you so much for joining us. The book, Food Fights and Culture Wars. Remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have what's in our food. Thank you all for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.